Hello, everyone, and welcome to our reading of the Associated Press News for Friday, the 20th of February. My name is Al, and our top story is the Supreme Court strikes down Trump's sweeping tariffs, upending the central plank of economic agenda. The dateline is Washington, and it's written by Lindsay Whitehurst. The Supreme Court struck down President Donald Trump's far-reaching global tariffs on Friday, handing him a significant loss on an issue crucial to his economic agenda. The 6-3 decision centers on tariffs imposed under an emergency powers law, including the sweeping reciprocal tariffs he levied on nearly every other country. It's the first major piece of Trump's broad agenda to come squarely before the nation's highest court, which he helped shape with the appointments of three conservative jurists in his first term. The majority found that the Constitution very clearly gives Congress the power to impose taxes, which include tariffs. The framers did not vest any part of the taxing power in the executive branch, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote. Justices Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Brett Kavanaugh dissented. The tariffs at issue here may or may not be wise policy, but as a matter of text, history, and precedent, they are clearly lawful, Kavanaugh wrote. Trump called the majority decision a disgrace when he was notified during his morning meeting with several governors, according to someone with direct knowledge of the president's reaction, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss private conversation. Trump was meeting privately with nearly 24 governors from both parties when the decision was released. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The court majority did not address whether companies could get refunded for the billions they have collected and paid in tariffs. Many companies, including the big box warehouse chain Costco, have already lined up to demand refunds in lower courts. Kavanaugh noted the process could be complicated. The court says nothing today about whether, and if so, how the government should go about returning the billions of dollars that is collected from importers, but that process is likely to be a mess, as was acknowledged at oral argument, he wrote. The Treasury has collected more than $133 billion from the import taxes the president has imposed under the Emergency Powers Law as of December, the federal data shows. The impact over the next decade was estimated at some $3 trillion. The tariffs decision doesn't stop Trump from imposing duties under other laws. While those have more limitations on the speed and severity of Trump's actions, top administration officials have said they expect to keep the tariff framework in place under other authorities. Still, the decision is a complete and total victory for the challengers, said Neil Keitel, who argued the case on behalf of a group of small businesses. It's reaffirmation of our deepest constitutional values and the idea that Congress is not any one man, controls the power to tax the American people, he said. The Supreme Court ruling comes despite a series of short-term wins on the court's emergency docket that have allowed Trump to push ahead with extraordinary flexes of executive power on issues ranging from high-profile firings to major federal funding cuts. The Republican president has been vocal about the case, calling it one of the most important in U.S. history, and saying a ruling against him would be an economic body blow to the country. But legal opposition crossed the political spectrum, including libertarian and pro-business groups that are typically aligned with the GOP. Polling has found tariffs are not broadly popular with the public amid wider voter concern about affordability. The Constitution gives Congress the power to levy tariffs, but the Trump administration argued that a 1977 law allowing the president to regulate importation during emergencies also allows him to set tariffs. Other presidents have used the law dozens of times, often to impose sanctions, but Trump was the first president to invoke it for import taxes. And the fact that no president has ever found such power in IEEPA is strong evidence that it does not exist, Roberts wrote, using an acronym for the law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Trump set what he called reciprocal tariffs on most countries in April of 2025, to address trade deficits that he declared a national emergency. Those came after he imposed duties on Canada, China, and Mexico, ostensibly to address a drug trafficking emergency. A series of lawsuits followed, including a case from a dozen largely Democratic-leaning states and others from small businesses selling everything from plumbing supplies to educational toys to women's cycling apparel. The challengers argued the emergency powers law does not even mention tariffs, and that Trump's use of it fails several legal tests, including one that doomed then-President Joe Biden's $500 billion student loan forgiveness program. The three conservative justices in the majority pointed out that the principle, which is called the Major Questions Doctrine, and holds that Congress must clearly authorize actions of major economic and political significance. There is no exception to the Major Questions Doctrine for emergency statutes, Roberts wrote. The three liberal justices who formed the rest of the majority did not join that part of the opinion. The Trump administration had argued that tariffs are different because they're a major part of Trump's approach to foreign affairs, an area where the courts should not be second-guessing the president. But Roberts, joined by Justices Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, brushed that aside, writing that foreign affairs implications do not change the legal principle. Associated Press writers Mark Sherman in Washington and Steve Peoples in New York contributed to this report. Now this related story from AP. U.S. stocks tick higher after the Supreme Court strikes down Trump's sweeping tariffs. The story written by AP's Stan Choi and its Dateline New York. U.S. stock prices ticked higher Friday after the Supreme Court struck down President Donald Trump's sweeping tariffs, which had triggered panic in financial markets when announced last year. The S&P 500 rose 0.6%. It had been flipping between small gains and losses earlier in the day following discouraging reports showing slowing growth for the U.S. economy and faster inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 124 points, or 0.3%, as of 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and the Nasdaq Composite was 1.1% higher. Many on Wall Street were likely expecting such a ruling from the Supreme Court. According to Brian Jacobson, the chief economic strategist at Annex Wealth Management, that likely led to the relatively muted reactions across the financial markets. Treasury yields edged only a bit higher in the bond market. Stock indexes in Europe added some to their gains from earlier in the day, while the U.S. dollar's value edged down against the euro and other currencies. Gold's price dipped from nearly $5,075 per ounce just before the ruling toward $5,000 before the climbing back. It had surged to records earlier this year, in part on worries about the uncertainty Trump's tariffs created for businesses and households worldwide. Despite the Supreme Court's blocking Trump from levying sweeping reciprocal tariffs on nearly every country in the world, tariffs may not be going away. Jacobson said he expects Trump's White House to shift strategy and use tariffs that target specific countries or industries. This will give some short-lived relief as it just delays the inevitable of tariffs from a different authority, he said. Heading into the day, the main event for markets had seemed to be the discouraging report showing slowing U.S. economic growth and accelerating inflation, but they also found a relatively muted response from investors. While the data underscored the tricky situation the Federal Reserve faces as it sets interest rates, they did not change traders' expectations much for what the Fed will ultimately do. Following the reports, traders were still mostly betting that the Fed will lower rates at least twice by the end of the year, according to data from CME Group. Some shifted bets for the timing of when the cuts could begin to slightly later in the summer. Lower interest rates would give the economy a boost, but they also risk worsening inflation. Fed officials said at their last meeting that they want to see inflation fall further before they would support cutting rates anymore. The yield on the 10-year Treasury rose to 4.09% from 4.08 late Thursday. The 2-year yield, which more closely tracks expectations for Fed action, inched up to 3.48%. On Wall Street, Akami Technologies dropped 9.3% for one of the market's sharpest losses. The cybersecurity and cloud computing company reported stronger results for the end of 2025 than analysts expected, but it gave a profit forecast for the upcoming year that fell short of estimates. Akami plans to spend a bigger percentage of its revenue this coming year on equipment and other investments. It's the latest potential indicator of how higher prices for computer memory amid shortages created by the AI boom is affecting customers throughout the economy. On the winning side of the market was Comfort Systems, which rose 4.3% after the provider of heating, ventilation, air conditioning, and electrical services reported a strong profit for the latest quarter than analysts expected. CEO Brian Lane said his company is seeing unprecedented demand. In stock markets abroad, indexes rose in Europe following a more mixed finish in Asia. The Hang Seng fell 1.1% after Hong Kong's market reopened following Lunar New Year holidays, but South Korea's KOSPI jumped 2.3% to a record, led by major defense contractors like Hanwha Aerospace. The company is one of many benefiting from a ramp-up in military spending in many countries. AP Business writers Matt Ott and Elaine Kurtenbach contributed to this report. The story from the AP Business section has more on the U.S. economy. U.S. economic growth weaker than thought in fourth quarter, with government shutdown, consumer pullback. The story written by the AP's Christopher Ruggeber and Matt Ott. Dateline Washington. U.S. economic growth slowed in the final 3 months of last year, dragged down by the six-week shutdown of the federal government and a pullback in consumer spending. The nation's gross domestic product, the total output of goods and services, increased at 1.4% annual rate in the fourth quarter, the Commerce Department reported Friday, down from 4.4% in the July-September quarter and 3.8% in the quarter before that. The figures point to a more modest pace of growth in the coming quarters as consumers take on more debt and cut back on savings to maintain their spending. Business investment outside data centers and other equipment dedicated to artificial intelligence grew at only a moderate pace. Still, a measure of underlying growth that focuses on consumer and business spending was mostly resilient, economists said. The sharp slowdown in government outlays because of the shutdown shaved a full percentage point from growth. Consumers and companies spent a reasonably solid pace, said Martha Gimbel, executive director of the Budget Lab at Yale and a former economist in the Biden White House. This is not a disastrous report, she said. Consumer spending rose 2.4%, a solid increase, but notably below the third quarter's healthy 3.5% gain. Federal government outlays plunged nearly 17% amid the shutdown, and that decline should mostly reverse in the coming quarters, however, which may boost growth a bit. The outsized growth last summer and fall partly reflected sharply lower imports. Companies ramped up imports in the first quarter of last year to get ahead of President Trump's tariffs. After sharply boosting growth in the second and third quarters, trade had little impact at the end of the year. Early Friday, before the figures were released, Trump attacked congressional Democrats for shutting down the federal government last fall. He also reiterated his criticism of Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell for not cutting interest rates more quickly. The Democrat shutdown cost the U.S. at least 2 points in GDP, Trump posted on his social media site. That's why they're doing it in mini form again, no shutdowns. Also, lower interest rates. Too late, Powell is the worst, according to Trump's quotes. Yet a separate report on Friday showed that inflation, according to the Fed's preferred measure, accelerated in December as the cost of goods such as furniture, clothes, and groceries picked up. Earlier this month, Trump predicted a blowout gain in GDP of more than 5%, even if the government shutdown was factored in to those figures. Trump has been trying to claim that the economy is at its strongest point in history, even though new government data show that the growth slowed compared with 2024 following his return to the White House. The weak data arrives before Trump delivers the State of the Union address next Tuesday, where he's expected to say the economy is booming. The report also underscores an odd aspect of the U.S. economy. It's growing steadily, but without creating many jobs. Growth was fairly healthy, 2.2% in 2025. Yet a government report last week showed that employers added fewer than 200,000 jobs last year, the fewest since COVID struck in 2020. Economists point to several possible reasons for the gap. The Trump administration's crackdown on immigration has sharply slowed population growth, reducing the number of people available to take jobs. It's one reason that the unemployment rate rose only slightly to 4.3% from 4% last year, even with the nearly non-existent hiring. Some businesses may also be holding back on adding jobs out of uncertainty about whether artificial intelligence will enable them to produce more without finding new employees. And the cost of tariffs has reduced many companies' profits, possibly leading them to cut back on hiring. The economy is also unusual right now because growth is solid, inflation has slowed a bit, and unemployment is low, but surveys show that Americans are generally gloomy about the economy. In January, a measure of consumer confidence fell to its lowest level since 2014, yet consumers have kept spending, propelling growth. Some of that spending may be disproportionately driven by upper-income consumers in a phenomenon known as the K-shaped economy. Yet data from many large banks suggests lower-income consumers are still raising their spending, even if by not as much. Associated Press writer Josh Boak contributed to this story. The next AP report is headlined, "Crews hope to resume recovery of 8 bodies from California avalanche after days of dangerous weather." The story is written by Goodfredo Vasquez, Julie Watson, and Hallie Golden. It's headlined, Soda Springs, California. Crews hope to resume efforts Friday to recover the bodies of 8 people killed and 1 still missing in an avalanche in California's Sierra Nevada after days of dangerous weather that has hampered safe access to the area. Authorities, meanwhile, are looking into the decision to follow through with the backcountry ski trip despite severe weather advisories. They're investigating whether anything would have been considered criminal negligence, said Ashley Quadros, a spokesperson with the Nevada County Sheriff's Office. She declined on Friday to share more, saying it's an open investigation. 6 of the people who died on the trip organized by a tour company were part of a close-knit group of friends who were experienced backcountry skiers and knew how to navigate the alpine wilderness, their family said on Thursday. The 3 others who are dead or presumed dead were guides. "We are devastated beyond words," the family said in a statement released through a spokesperson. The women were mothers, wives, and friends who connected through the love of the outdoors, they said, and were carrying avalanche safety equipment and prepared for backcountry travel. The 6 were identified as Carrie Atkin, Liz Claybaugh, Danielle Keatley, Kate Morse, Caroline Secker, and Kate Vitt, and they lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, in Idaho, and in the Lake Tahoe area. The families asked for privacy while they grieve. The names of the other victims have not been released. 2 from the group of friends survived and were rescued along with 4 others, including a guide. Avalanche warnings were set to expire Friday, and drier and milder conditions were predicted for the weekend, according to the Sierra Avalanche Center. The slide is the deadliest in the U.S. since 1981, when 11 climbers were killed on Mount Rainier in Washington State. The 15 skiers began their 3-day trip Sunday just as warnings about the storm were intensifying. By early Tuesday, officials cautioned that avalanches were expected. What the guides and their tour company knew about the warnings and why they pressed on is now part of an investigation by local authorities and a state agency that regulates workplace safety. Avalanche safety experts say it is not uncommon for backcountry skiers to go out when there is an avalanche watch or even a warning. Blackbird Mountain Guides, which was leading the expedition, said the guides who were on the trek were trained or certified in backcountry skiing and were instructors with the American Institute for Avalanche Research and Education. While in the field, guides are in communication with senior guides at our base to discuss conditions and routing based upon conditions, founder Zeb Blay said in a statement. California Governor Newsom said some of his wife's old family friends were on the trip. The Newsoms have a home in Marin County, where some of the people on the trip lived. His office did not immediately provide more details. There were some experienced guides that were out there, and that's what's even more concerning and disturbing, he said at a news conference on Thursday. Sekar and Claybaugh were sisters. Their brother, McAllister Claybaugh, told the New York Times. Sekar was a mother of two who lived in San Francisco, and Liz Claybaugh worked for St. Luke's Health System in Boise, Idaho, according to her LinkedIn page. Vitt lived in San Francisco and worked previously at Sirius XM and Pandora, according to her LinkedIn page. The Kentsfield School District sent an email to families Wednesday saying that her two sons are safe and are with their father, Jeff, as they navigate this profound loss, according to the New York Times. Atkin lived with her husband and two children and was a former corporate executive at Division I track and field athlete, according to her leadership coaching website. Some members of the group had ties to the Elite Sugar Bowl Academy, a private boarding and day school for competitive skiers and snowboarders, whose former students include multiple Olympians. One of the victims was married to a member of the backcountry search and rescue team in the area, Placer County Sheriff Wayne Wu said. Watson reported from San Diego and Golden from Seattle. Associated Press writers John Sewer in Toledo, Ohio, Matthew Brown in Billings, Montana, R.J. Rico in Atlanta, and Christopher Weber in Los Angeles contributed to the report. The next AP story is entitled, Growing Number of Americans Report Experiencing Extreme Cold, AP NORC Poll Finds. The story written by Isabella O'Malley and Amelia Thompson DeVoe. It's Dateline Washington. Millions in North America kicked off 2026 with bitterly cold temperatures, with many saying it's been years since they've experienced such frigid winter weather. Pipes that never froze on me for 15 years froze, said Chris Farrell, who's 58, from Brooklyn, New York, about the abnormally cold temperatures he experienced in January and February. Farrell owns several residential properties in Albany and said multiple days of below-freezing temperatures prevented him from doing repairs and renovations. He said he was thankful that none of the pipes burst and that this winter had the same bitter cold he remembers from when he was young, which contrasts with the relatively warm winters he experienced in recent years. About 6 in 10 U.S. adults say they've been personally affected by severe cold weather or severe winter storms in the past 5 years, according to a new poll from the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. That's an increase from an AP NORC poll conducted in February 2025, when about half of the U.S. adults said they'd been affected by extreme cold. The finding points to the growing prevalence of experiences with cold weather, or at least people's perception of them, after a massive winter storm brought freezing temperatures to the East Coast and caused widespread power outages in the South. In a warming world, people's reactions to cold weather are subjective. Scientific research indicates the first quarter of the 21st century was unusually warm by historical standards, mostly due to human-induced climate change. And abnormally cold winters are happening less frequently in North America. Because this type of extreme cold occurs less frequently, experts say Americans are experiencing it more intensely now than they did in the past, and prolonged cold spells are unfamiliar to many people, especially younger Americans. In the summer of 2024, an AP NORC poll found that about 7 in 10 U.S. adults had experienced extremely hot weather or extreme heat waves in the prior 5 years. Higher electric bills, schoolwork, and cancellations, and more. The most recent survey found that just in the past year, Americans' lives have been upended in multiple ways by cold weather. About 7 in 10 Americans say that in the past year, their electricity or gas bills have been higher than usual because of winter storms or extreme cold. About 4 in 10 have experienced a work or school cancellation because of winter storms or extreme cold. Roughly one-third have experienced a power outage, and about 3 in 10 have had a travel cancellation or delay. Annie Braswell, who's 66 from Greenville, North Carolina, said January and February felt like it hadn't been quite that cold in 40 years, and that her utility bill doubled compared with normal. She said it was a dramatic change from the weather she experienced last summer when she endured many days at or above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. I just take life one day at a time, and I realize these are things I can't change, Braswell said, about how she copes with the extreme temperatures. Heat waves and extreme cold require more heating and cooling to keep temperatures inside homes and buildings comfortable, which leads to higher utility bills. Electricity prices are rising in the U.S., and an AP NORC poll from October 2025 found that nearly 4 in 10 U.S. adults say the cost of electricity is a major source of stress for them. Bill McKibben, a longtime climate activist, told the Associated Press in a separate interview that he thinks risking electricity prices, or rising electricity prices, we should say, will have a major political impact. The effects of cold weather were felt across wide swaths of the country. About 6 in 10 Midwesterners, about half of Southerners, and about 4 in 10 Northeasterners say they've experienced work or school cancellation as a result of winter storms or extreme cold, compared with 15% of adults who live in the West. Linking extreme cold and climate change. Among all of the people who experienced some kind of severe weather event in the past few years, including extreme heat, extreme cold, major droughts or water shortages, hurricanes or severe tropical storms, major flooding, wildfires, tornadoes, about two-thirds believe climate change was the cause. I think climate change is a natural thing that happens. To some extent, it's sped up by some things, such as pollutants released from factories and the shipping industry, said Joseph Bird, who's 21, a college student in Provo, Utah, who identifies as an independent. I think it increases the frequency of extreme weather, is how I see it, said Bird. Democrats and independents who experienced any kind of severe weather or event are much likelier than Republicans to see climate change as a cause. There is a particularly large gap between conservative Republicans. Only about 3 in 10 who experienced an extreme weather event think it was related to climate change, compared with the liberal Democrats, the vast majority of whom think climate change was involved. While rising atmospheric temperatures are a result of global warming, scientists say that extreme cold outbreaks across North America are a feature of climate change. The Arctic polar vortex, a swirling area of low pressure and cold air that's typically trapped over the North Pole throughout the year, can stretch down and infiltrate regions further south. Scientific research indicates such polar vortex disruptions are happening more frequently due to rapidly warming temperatures in the Arctic and shrinking Arctic sea ice. Nearly all Americans have experienced some kind of extreme weather recently. Overall, the vast majority of U.S. adults, 80%, have experienced some kind of severe weather event in the past 5 years, although they are not much likelier to report experiencing extremely hot weather or extreme heat waves and extreme cold in the past 5 years than any other kind of major weather events, including major droughts or water shortages, hurricanes or severe tropical storms, major flooding, wildfires, tornadoes, or other severe weather events or weather disasters. There are no meaningful partisan differences in Americans' experiences of weather, extreme weather, but about 8 in 10 Democrats who experienced any of these extreme weather events said they were the result of climate change, compared with only about 4 in 10 Republicans. O'Malley reported from Philadelphia from this story. The AP NORC poll of 1,156 adults was conducted February 5th through the 8th, using a sample drawn from NORC's probability-based Amerispeak panel, which is designed to be representative of the U.S. population. The margin of sampling error for adults overall is plus or minus 3.9 percentage points. Our next headline is NASA targets March for first moon mission by Artemis astronauts after fueling test success. The story written by Marcia Dunn, and it's datelined Cape Canaveral, Florida. NASA aims to send astronauts to the moon in March after acing the latest rocket fueling test. Administrator Jared Isaacman said Friday that launch teams made major progress between the first countdown rehearsal, which was disrupted by hydrogen leaks earlier this month, and the second test, which was completed without significant seepage Thursday night. The test was a big step toward America's return to the lunar environment, Isaacman said on the social media platform X. NASA could launch four astronauts on the Artemis II lunar flyaround as soon as March 6th from Florida's Kennedy Space Center. To keep their options open, the three Americans and one Canadian plan to go into the mandatory two-week health quarantine Friday night. The space agency has only 5 days in March to launch the crew aboard the Space Launch System rocket before standing down until April. February's opportunities evaporated after dangerous amounts of liquid hydrogen leaked during the first fueling demonstration. Technicians then replaced two seals, leading to Thursday's successful rerun. The countdown clock went all the way down to the desired 29-second mark. The fixes worked, but there is still pending work, including conducting a flight readiness review, said NASA's Lori Glaze. Commander Reid Wiseman and two of his crew monitored Thursday's operation alongside launch controllers. The astronauts will be the first to fly to the moon since Apollo 17 closed NASA's first chapter in moon exploration in 1972. The Associated Press Health and Science Department received support from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute's Department of Science Education and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The AP is solely responsible for all content. The next story is headlined, U.S. House campaigns are underway, yet a redistricting battle triggered by Trump rages in some states. It's written by David Lieb. Candidates are campaigning and voting is underway in some primaries, yet a national battle to redraw U.S. House districts for partisan advantage is still raging in some states ahead of the November midterm elections. Final boundaries for congressional voting districts remain uncertain in Missouri, New York, Utah, and Virginia. Governors in Florida and Maryland are pushing lawmakers to reshape House districts. And that all comes on top of redistricting changes already enacted in California, North Carolina, Ohio, and Texas. Voting districts typically are redrawn once a decade after each census, but President Donald Trump triggered an unusual round of mid-decade redistricting when he urged Texas Republicans last summer to redraw House districts to give the GOP an edge in the midterm elections. California Democrats reciprocated, and a tit-for-tat redistricting clash soon spread. So far, Republicans believe they could win 9 additional seats in states where they have redrawn congressional districts, while Democrats think they could gain 6 seats elsewhere because of redistricting. But that presumes past voting patterns hold true in November, and that's uncertain, especially since the party in power typically loses seats in the midterms, and Trump's faced negative approval ratings in polls. Democrats need to gain just a few seats in November to wrest control of the House from Republicans, which could allow them to obstruct Trump's agenda. Virginia, the current map is 6 Democrats, 5 Republicans. the proposed map, a new House map, could help Democrats win up to 4 additional seats. To facilitate that, the General Assembly referred a constitutional amendment to the April ballot that would allow mid-decade redistricting. In Maryland, the Democratic-led House passed a redistricting plan backed by Democratic Governor Wes Moore that could help Democrats win an additional seat. In Missouri, 2 Democrats and 6 Republicans are seated now. The new map, Republican Governor Mike Kehoe signed a revised House map into law last fall that could help Republicans win an additional seat. In Utah, there are no Democrats and 4 Republicans now. A judge in November imposed revised House districts that could help Democrats win a seat. The court ruled that lawmakers had circumvented anti-gerrymandering standards passed by voters when adopting their prior map. In New York, there are now 19 Democrats and 7 Republicans. A judge in January ordered a state commission to draw new boundaries for the only congressional district in New York, a city that's represented by a Republican, ruling it unconstitutionally dilutes the votes of Black and Hispanic residents. In Florida, there are now 8 Democrats, 20 Republicans. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis says he'll call a special legislative session in April on congressional redistricting. In Texas, there are now 13 Democrats and 25 Republicans. Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed a revised House map into law last August that could help Republicans win 5 additional seats. In California, there are now 43 Democrats and 9 Republicans. Voters in November approved revised House districts drawn by the Democratic-led legislature that could help Democrats win 5 additional seats. In North Carolina, there are now 4 Democrats and 10 Republicans. The Republican-led General Assembly gave final approval in October to revise districts that could help the GOP win an additional seat. In Ohio, there are now 5 Democrats and 10 Republicans. A bipartisan panel composed primarily of Republicans voted in October to approve revised House districts that improve Republicans' chances of winning 2 additional seats. In Louisiana, there are 2 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Republican Governor Jeff Landry signed legislation in October to delay the state's primary election from April 18th till May 16th. That could give lawmakers extra time to redraw House districts if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns the current ones. South Carolina now has 1 Democrat and 6 Republicans. A legislative committee is considering a congressional redistricting plan that could help Republicans win an additional seat. In Colorado, 4 Democrats and 4 Republicans are now seated. A proposed ballot initiative would authorize mid-decade redistricting and impose a new House map that could help the Democrats win 3 additional seats. Washington State has 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans. The proposed map, these Democratic lawmakers proposing a constitutional amendment that will allow mid-decade redistricting. And in Wisconsin, the current map has 2 Democrats and 6 Republicans. 2 lawsuits assert that congressional districts must be redrawn because they unconstitutionally favor the Republicans. The next story is headlined, Federal Judge Accuses Trump Administration of Terror Against Immigrants in Scathing Ruling. The story written by Sudhin Thanwala. And it begins, a federal judge has accused the Trump administration of terrorizing immigrants and recklessly violating the law in its efforts to deport millions of people living in the country illegally. Citing the deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minnesota, the judge said the White House had also extended its violence on its own citizens. The threats posed by the executive branch cannot be viewed in isolation, U.S. District Judge Sunshine Sykes in Riverside, California, said in a scathing decision. Sykes said the administration had violated her December ruling that found it was illegally denying many detained immigrants a chance for release. She ordered the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to provide them with notice that they may be eligible for bond and then give them access to phones to call an attorney within an hour. She also threw out a September ruling by an immigration court that the administration had cited for continuing its mandatory detention policy. The White House referred comment to the Homeland Security Department. The department said in a statement that the Supreme Court had repeatedly overruled lower courts on the issue of mandatory detention. ICE has the law and the facts on its side, and it adheres to all court decisions until it ultimately gets them shot down by the highest court in the land, the statement said. Under past administrations, people with no criminal record could generally request a bond hearing before an immigration judge while their cases wound through immigration court, unless they were stopped at the border. President Donald Trump's White House reversed that practice. With access to bond hearings cut off, immigrants by the thousands filed separate petitions in federal court seeking their release. More than 20,000 habeas corpus cases have been filed since Trump's inauguration, according to federal court records analyzed by the AP. Judges have granted many of those petitions, but then later found the administration was violating their orders to release people or provide them with other relief. A federal judge in Minnesota took the rare step of finding a Trump administration lawyer in contempt of court over the government's failure to comply with an order to return identification documents to an immigrant the judge had found and ordered released. A federal judge in New Jersey this week ordered the administration to explain what procedures are in place to ensure court orders in this district are followed consistently and on time. U.S. District Judge Michael Fabiard said Tuesday that Trump officials failed to meet court order deadlines for bond hearings in immigration court in 12 of roughly 550 cases since December the 5th. Judicial orders should never be violated, he wrote. Sykes, who was nominated by President Joe Biden, a Democrat, ruled in November again in December that the mandatory detention policy violated an act of Congress. She extended her decision to immigrants nationwide. The Republican administration, however, continued denying bond hearings. This next story from the AP World News section is headlined, Israeli Settlers Kill 19-Year-Old Palestinian American, Officials and Witnesses Say. The story written by Imad Issoud and Melanie Lidman, and it's Dateline Mukmas, West Bank. Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank shot and killed a Palestinian-American man during an attack on a village, the Palestinian Health Ministry, and a witness said Thursday. Raed Abu Ali, a resident of Mukmas, said a group of settlers came to the village Wednesday afternoon where they attacked a farmer, prompting clashes after residents intervened. Israeli forces later arrived, and during the violence, armed settlers killed 19-year-old Nasrallah Abu Simam and injured several others. Abu Ali said that the army shot tear gas, sound grenades, and live ammunition. Israel's military acknowledged using what it called riot dispersal methods after receiving reports of Palestinians throwing rocks, but denied that its forces fired during the clashes. When the settlers saw the army, they were encouraged and started shooting live bullets, Abu Ali said. He added that they clubbed those injured with sticks after they had fallen to the ground. The Palestinian Ministry of Health confirmed Abu Siam's death from critical wounds sustained Wednesday afternoon near the Israeli village east of Ramallah. Abu Siam's killing is the latest in a surge of violence in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces and settlers killed 240 Palestinians last year, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Palestinians killed 17 Israelis over the same period, six of whom were soldiers. The Palestinian Authority's Wall and Settlement Resistance Commission said Abu Siam was the first Palestinian killed by settlers in 2026. Mukmas and its surrounding area, most of which lies under Israeli civil and military administration, have become a hotspot for settler attacks, including arson and assaults, as well as the construction of outposts that Israeli law considers illegal. The Israeli military said Wednesday late that the unnamed suspect shot at Palestinians who were later evacuated for medical treatment. It did not say whether there were any arrests. Abu Siam's mother told the Associated Press that he was an American citizen, making him the second Palestinian-American to be killed by Israeli settlers in less than a year. A U.S. embassy spokesman said they, quote, condemn this violence. Palestinians and rights groups say authorities routinely fail to prosecute settlers or hold them accountable for violence. UN says Israel's acts in West Bank may be ethnic cleansing. The UN Human Rights Office accused Israel of war crimes and said practices that displace Palestinians and alter the demographic composition of the occupied West Bank raise concerns over ethnic cleansing. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, citing findings collected in November 2024 to October 2025, said Israel was engaged in concerted and accelerating efforts to consolidate annexation while maintaining a system to, quote, maintain oppression and domination of Palestinians. Residents of Palestinian villages and herding communities have been increasingly displaced as Israeli settlements and outposts expanded. Since the start of the Israel-Hamas war, the Israeli rights group B'Tselem says about 40 Palestinian communities have been emptied out completely amid Israeli demolition orders and settler attacks. Additionally, the office said Israeli military operations in the northern West Bank employed means and methods designed for warfare, including lethal airstrikes and forcibly transferring civilians from their homes. It also said Israel forbade residents from returning to their homes in the northern West Bank refugee camps. The operation, which Israel said was aimed against militants, displaced tens of thousands of Palestinians. The report also accused Palestinian security forces of using unnecessary lethal force in the same areas, killing at least 8 people, and noted that Palestinian Authority had engaged in intimidation, detention, and ill treatment of journalists, human rights defenders, and other individuals deemed critical of its rule. Neither Israel's foreign ministry nor the Palestinian Authority responded to requests for comment. Israel has repeatedly accused the UN Rights Office of anti-Israel bias. Last year, the UN Human Rights Monitor warned of what it called an unfolding genocide in Gaza, with conditions of life increasingly incompatible with Palestinians' continued existence. The report on Thursday also warned of demographic shifts in Gaza, raising concerns of ethnic cleansing. The headline on our next story, police search former Prince Andrew's home a day after his arrest. The story written by the AP's Pan Pilas. The dateline is London. Police searched the former home of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor again on Friday, a day after he was arrested and held in custody for nearly 11 hours on suspicion of misconduct in public office related to his friendship with the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Following one of the most tumultuous days in the modern history of Britain's royal family, the former Prince Andrew is back at his new residence in the Sandringham Estate, King Charles III's private retreat, which is about 115 miles north of London. Police have concluded their search at Wood Farm, where Mountbatten Windsor is living, while waiting for his new home nearby, Marsh Farm, to be ready. They're still searching Royal Lodge, his 30-room former home in the parkland near Windsor Castle, just west of the capital, where the king's younger brother had lived for decades until his eviction earlier this month. Unmarked vans believed to be police vehicles have been entering the grounds throughout Friday. Mountbatten Windsor, who was pictured slouched in the back of his chauffeur-driven car following his release Thursday evening from a police station near Sandringham, remains under investigation, which means he has neither been charged nor exonerated by Thames Valley Police, the former force responsible for the area west of London. Arrest was years in the making. His arrest follows years of allegations over his links with Epstein, who took his own life in a New York jail in 2019. The accusation at the heart of his arrest is that Mountbatten Windsor, who was known as Prince Andrew until October, when his brother stripped him of his titles and honors and banished him from Royal Lodge, shared confidential trade information with the disgraced financier when he was a trade envoy for the UK. Specifically, emails released last month by the U.S. Department of Justice appeared to show Mountbatten Windsor sharing reports of official visits to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and Singapore. One dated November of 2010 appeared to be forwarded by Andrew 5 minutes after he received it. Another a few weeks later appeared to show him sending Epstein a confidential brief on investment opportunities in the reconstruction of Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Thames Valley Police has previously said it was also reviewing allegations that a woman was trafficked to the UK by Epstein to have a sexual encounter with Andrew. Thursday's arrest had nothing to do with that. Other police forces are also conducting their own investigations into Epstein's links to the UK, including the assessment of flight logs at airports, large and small. They're coordinating their work within a national group. On Friday, London's Metropolitan Police said it was assessing, with the help of U.S. counterparts, whether the capital's airports, which included Heathrow, may have been used to facilitate human trafficking and sexual exploitation. It also said it's asking past and present officers who protected Mountbatten Windsor to carefully consider whether they saw or heard anything that may be relevant to those investigations. As of now, it said no new criminal allegations have been made regarding sexual offenses within its jurisdiction. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing in his association with Epstein, but has not commented on the most recent allegations that have emerged with the release of the so-called Epstein files. Arrest was sudden. Investigation will take time. Police swept into the grounds of Mountbatten Windsor's home to arrest him at 8 a.m. on Thursday, his 66th birthday, before taking him to Alisham Police Station for questioning. It's not known what he told them. He may have said nothing or no comment, as is his right. Experts said that misconduct in public office is notoriously difficult to prove. Firstly, it must be determined if Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was in a role within the government constitutes the title of public officer, said Sean Caulfield, a criminal defense lawyer at Hodges, Joan and Allen. There's no standard definition to clearly draw on. The Crown Prosecution Service will ultimately make a decision about charging Mountbatten Windsor, who remains eighth in the line to the throne. Andrew Gilmore, a partner at Grosvenor Law, said prosecutors will apply the two-stage test known as the Code for Crown Prosecutors. That test is to determine whether there is more realistic prospect of a conviction than not based on the evidence, and whether the matter is in the public interest, he said. If these two tests are met, then the matter will be charged and proceed to court. Our final story is headlined, Eric Dane, Grey's Anatomy star and ALS awareness advocate, dies at 53. The story written by Maria Sherman. Eric Dane, the celebrated actor best known for his roles on Grey's Anatomy and Euphoria, and who later in life became an advocate for ALS awareness, died Thursday. He was 53. His representative said Dane died from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, known as Lou Gehrig's disease, less than a year after he announced his diagnosis. He spent his final days surrounded by dear friends, his devoted wife, and his two beautiful daughters, Billy and Georgia, who were the center of his world, said a statement that requested privacy for his family. Throughout his journey with ALS, Eric became a passionate advocate for awareness and research, determined to make a difference for others facing the same fight. He will be deeply missed and lovingly remembered as always. Eric adored his fans and is forever grateful to the outpouring of love and support he's received. Dane developed a devoted fan base when his big break arrived in the mid-2000s. He was cast as Dr. Mark Sloan, a.k.a. McSteamy, on the ABC medical drama Grey's Anatomy, a role he would play from 2006 until 2012 and then reprise in 2021. Although his character was killed off the show after a plane crash, Dane's character left an indelible mark on the still-running show. Seattle Grace Hospital became Grey Sloan Memorial Hospital. In 2019, he did a complete 180 from the charming McSteamy and became the troubled Cal Jacobs in HBO's provocative drama Euphoria, a role he continued up until his death. Dane also starred as Tom Chandler, the captain of a U.S. Navy destroyer at sea after a global catastrophe wiped out most of the world's population in the TNT drama The Last Ship. In 2017, production was halted as Dane battled depression. In April 2025, Dane announced he had been diagnosed with ALS, a progressive disease that attacks nerve cells controlling muscles throughout the body. ALS gradually destroys the nerve cells and connections needed to walk, talk, speak, and breathe. Most patients die within 3 to 5 years of a diagnosis. Dane became an advocate for ALS awareness, speaking at a news conference in Washington on health insurance prior authorization. Some of you may know me from TV shows such as Grey's Anatomy, which I play a doctor, but I am here today to speak briefly as a patient battling ALS, he said, in June of 2025. In September of last year, the ALS Network named Dane the recipient of their Advocate of the Year Award, recognizing his commitment to raising awareness and support for people living with ALS. Dane was born on November 9, 1972, and raised in Northern California. His father, who the actor said was a Navy veteran and an architect, died of a gunshot wound when Dane was just 7 years old. After high school, he moved to Los Angeles to pursue acting, landing guest roles on shows such as Saved by the Bell, Married with Children, Charmed, and X-Men, The Last Stand, and one season of the short-lived medical drama Gideon's Crossing. This has been your reading today of the Associated Press news. It is published on Friday, February the 20th. And my name is Al, reading on the Talking Information Center.